Hello, beautiful people, and welcome to Fantie, the podcast for all those complex and complicated conversations about the gray areas in our lives. I am journalist, writer, and producer Jared Hill.
And I am journalist and editor Travelle Anderson. Coming up on the show today, we are going to talk a little bit about advocacy. Okay, advocacy. Okay.
Wow. That actually sounds like someone's name.
Advocacy?
like her last name is Casey and her first name is Advo. Hey, Advo, Casey.
Not just me. Gendered her, but okay.
I mean, it gave. I saw a woman when I said it, but
you should degender what you see in your head. Coming up, we're gonna do a tough question, Jared. That comes from you.
So one of the things that's been really on my mind a lot lately is the sharing and rebroadcast of violence against Black and Brown people. I think I'd mentioned recently having been avoiding the news for a while and turning it back on for the first time. I guess this was a couple of weeks ago now before I took some time off. And within the first 5 minutes, I was seeing Derek Chauvin's murder of George Floyd in the street. And then even since then, we've seen the two different cases that have happened most recently, Dante Wright being killed in Minnesota and Lieutenant, what I believe is Karan Nazario, and the way that the police essentially attacked him sitting in his vehicle. I've been off social media for quite a bit right now, and so gradually I'm coming back into it bit by bit. But the first day that I got back into scrolling and sharing on my Instagram, I saw about five times this Karan Nazario situation, and I was like frustrated that I kept seeing people posting it in their feeds and into their stories and things like that. And I guess for me, it's really, really triggering and frustrating and upsetting and traumatizing to keep seeing those things again and again and again. I will say that I eventually went and I saw them both on the news, I should say, over the course of the past couple of days. And they're both awful things to see. And I don't want to keep seeing them. And so I did a post on social media in my Insta story saying, like, we need people to stop sharing these videos. I don't ever need to see another Black person attacked by police officers or by white people or, frankly, another Asian person being attacked or any other person being attacked in racist violence. And then I got a DM from someone who is a white colleague of mine at one of my old jobs saying, quote, "When I see it, it makes me very angry. So angry that I want to live a life as an ally. So angry that I want to continue casting my votes for allies. So angry that I want to keep supporting racial equality causes. So while it is painful, it serves a purpose." And I responded to him saying, That's a very white perspective, right? Like, we have 400 years of history of these kinds of different things happening over the course of American history. And like, I don't need to keep seeing it to be reminded that we are dehumanized and degraded and mistreated throughout this country by the state. And so for white people that need to continue seeing it, I think you need to ask yourself why. But moreover, I guess the question for me is, should we be posting and sharing these videos? Because I also do recognize that they have a value in society and culture for amplifying these stories. We wouldn't be having the quote unquote racial reckoning that we had last year. We wouldn't have Black Lives Matter if we hadn't had, you know, the Michael Brown story and the Trayvon Martin stories going viral in the ways that they have. How do you feel about the sharing and posting of these videos?
So, I mean, I have to admit and say that I haven't seen not nail one of these videos. Mm-hmm. And even though they have been posted on my social media, and I don't know if it's because I got a quick little flick of the wrist. What they call it? A little flick of the wrist? A little quick flick of the wrist? Is that what the kids say?
Well, when your wrist is limp, it's easy to just... Sorry, I didn't have to do that. I didn't. That wasn't necessary. It just wasn't.
Anyway, so I haven't actually seen any of the videos. I haven't seen George Floyd? I haven't seen the George Floyd video. The last video I saw was, I believe, Alton Sterling. Was the last video I saw. And then I don't watch TV news. Mm-hmm. So like, there's no way besides social media that it pops up into my consciousness. And like I said, you know, if it's on Twitter, you know, you have to click into it for the video to start. And then on Instagram, a number of videos play automatically. But like I said, I just scroll through it. That being said, I find it interesting what you said your colleague said to you, your white colleague said, because, right, historically, what we do know is that, like, the civil rights movement, right, they used media as a means of showing the world, but in particular, white Americans, the violence that white folks in the South were enacting on Black mm-hmm. folks. And it was because of the broadcasts, right, on news, and it was because of the newspapers covering it that white folks, you know, eventually were like, okay, let's stop this whole, you know, post-slavery stuff, this Jim Crow era. And so I do think there is a utility in it for them. I don't think necessarily there's a utility in it for us. And last night we got a text from a friend of ours. I won't say his name, but he sent the group chat, you know, the live feed of the protests that were happening in Minnesota. Is it Minnesota? Yeah, Minnesota.
Yeah.
And, you know, I simply said to the group chat, I said, protect your peace. And for me, that means not watching the videos. It might mean something different for you all. But I definitely think as journalists and as newsmakers and media folks, I think the default response is that we need that kind of visual companion to accompany the storytelling, mm-hmm. Particularly on news. That's what they say, right? The question does become, what other visuals can we use to accompany the storytelling, particularly, right, with the Derek Chauvin trial happening right now? You don't have to keep playing, you know, George Floyd being killed over and over and over and over again. But the question is, what else can you use? I don't know. Use pictures of people, you know, or something, you know, just you don't have to show that violence and that aspect of the violence over and over for people to get it. But here's the thing. Most of these newscasts aren't being done with Black people in mind.
No.
Hell, they're not being done with Black people behind the scenes making various decisions. And so they're being done with white people in mind, and they're showing it because I think the same intention that the civil rights movement folks were thinking about the media. And perhaps that is something that, you know, needs to be reconsidered for sure.
I can tell you that as best I know, I've been Black my whole life. And I know that before adulthood and before Trayvon Martin and Mike Brown, and like we started seeing more and more of these videos, I always had an active concern about policing because my dad is Black, my uncles are Black, my, you know, cousins are Black. Like, we have had plenty of issues where, you know, folks have been dealt with by the police in ways that were inequitable or inhumane. And then since having seen the videos time and time again, I know that I have had so many instances where my anxiety will go through the roof if I am in proximity to a police officer. And because we've seen this so many times now, and I think that mm-hmm. if it is necessary for white people to see Black people being attacked by police officers to remember not to be racist, I think there's a bigger problem, right? But
sure.
I know for myself, being in a Starbucks and ordering my drink and turning around to go stand and wait for it and seeing a police officer across the room and like having a full panic inside of myself because I did not want to interact with him, but I didn't want to look like I didn't want to interact with him, but I didn't want to make eye contact, but I didn't want to avoid eye contact because I know it looks suspicious, and I didn't want to go throw away the thing in my hand because he was over near the garbage can. And it creates a whole thing for me, seeing police officers, whether they're on the sidewalk, if they're driving behind me, or whatever it is. It's terrible.
I have a question, though. The folks that you see who are posting the video, are they Black? Are they white? Are they, you know...
More often than not, it's Black
folks.
Of
color? Right. Which makes me wonder about even this conversation that we're having now, right? If Black folks are the ones sharing it, right? There's obviously some Black people like yourself who are like, this is deeply traumatic. I don't want to see this. But you also have other Black folks, I'm assuming, who are sharing it because they want to make sure that it's not ignored. They want to make sure that people know about it. They want to make sure that people, Black, white, or otherwise, are activated, mm-hmm. right, by the sight of what they see. What can be done? And we should also say, right, I wonder if the frequency with which we might see these videos all in a finite period of time, how it's the frequency of seeing this video pop up on people's feeds, not necessarily just seeing the video pop up on a feed, that drives some Black people and then the broader community, the broader, you know, human race, if you will, to feel a way, right? Your colleague, is it the fact that he saw the video 10 times and that is what activated something in him? Or is it the fact that he just saw the video? Am I making any sense?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, usually not, but in this instance, I think there's validity to your question. I guess for myself, when I'm seeing people posting it again and again and again, and it's like, what the fuck? Or I'm sick of this shit or something like that. It's like, you didn't need to post this. I think that when I see Benjamin Crump or, you know, I don't think Brittany Packnett, Cunningham Packs post them. But like when I see different like activists and folks in the movement posting it, I kind of expect that because that is the work, right? And being engaged in that is the work. But I also,
it's their work.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Slight that's edit. The work.
Well, for but them. I'm just saying, yeah. I want to be clear that it's their work and not necessary. Because, you know, the girls feel a way about a lot of the activist girls now. And so,
well, right.
You know, dot, dot, dot.
That's the work for folks in that work.
For them.
Mm-hmm. And, like, I get that. But, like, when it's just, like, your homie and, like, you know, a bunch of angry emojis or something, I'm just like, I don't see the value in you sharing this. Another point that I'll make before we wrap this up, I really want to highlight, like, I cannot overstate the level of fatigue. Like, I just came back from being off for the last week, and like last night, Monday night, when I was, you know, tuning in and seeing all of the protests, like, it emotionally drained me immediately. And I ended up having a conversation with a friend and saying, like, I feel like we're about to slide back into the summer of 2020, and I don't know that I have the emotional bandwidth for that. Because we all went through that and spent a lot of time talking months later about what it felt like. And I just don't know that I have that in me again.
Is there a case to be made for dissociating?
You mean like
from it
turning
all?
It all off?
No. I don't even mean turning it off. I mean not. To be quite honest, I feel like when I see... the posting of any video, not the actual contents of the video, but the posting of the video and the captions, like you just mentioned, of like, it happened again, or da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, while yes, I am tired and beyond tired of all of it, I also feel like I've dissociated a little bit. Like, it's nothing new. I'm going to keep doing what I've been doing as it relates to visibility, as it relates to be, you know, to supporting the organizers and all of that. It just does not change anything in me as an individual. And I don't even know if that's actual dissociation or not. But, you know, that's what's in my head and how I guess, respond or don't respond, yeah. I guess, you know, to it all. And I don't know if dissociating is something that, you know, folks can actually like legitimately do or feel like they can do. And by folks, I'm talking about niggas. But
what do you mean by disassociate though? Like, what do you mean?
I mean, I am not upset by people sharing the video. Mm-hmm. I am not concerned about people sharing the. I'm not concerned about people, you know, feeling a way or not feeling a way. Because guess what? The world is still gonna spin, whether you care or you don't care, right? And the system is still the system. And until we undo and blow up the system, it's gonna continue to operate the way it was created to operate. And so I invest my energy, I think, just into other stuff, as opposed to into, you know, outrage at the video or outrage at the consistent, you know, an incessant sharing and playing of the video.
I'll say I don't know what the right answer is. I know that I have no interest in like sharing these videos and putting them into the feeds of the things that I'm doing. I feel like I talk enough about race and racism and politics, and I tweeted recently like I can't continue to center my work on that because it's really taking a toll on me as an individual. But it's something that I really wish people would be more mindful and thoughtful about, at the very least, in the ways that they share that stuff. So that's gonna do it for us with this segment and the tough question. All right, as we go to break, we don't normally have a question here for y'all, but we'd like to ask you, like, especially the Black folks that are listening, love you white people, but what are you doing to protect your peace and to prioritize your peace in this moment as we are seeing these uprisings begin again? Let us know. You can tweet us at #FantiFam and at Fanti Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. And you can shoot us an email, Fanti at MaximumFun.org. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, we're talking about advocacy and the ways that it shows up in our lives, both professionally and personally. Don't go anywhere. We're coming right back.
Hey, y'all, we want to tell y'all about a new sponsor of the show that you all have to check out. They're called Lumi Labs Microdose Drops, okay? Mm. So now, in case you are not familiar with the microdose of it all, microdose is really different from other hemp products because it contains micro doses, okay, of THC to be exact. And that's in balance with cannabinoids like CBD and CBG. This way, you can eat just one microdose and feel a nice mood lift from the THC without getting high. You're probably listening, you're like, I don't know what they are even saying right now. Okay, what we're talking about is these little they're like droplets, right? That you can
say like little tabs.
Yeah, little tabs, and you can take them, and what they do is they have really great effects in terms, or at least for me, they mellowed me out when I was really stressed or I had like huge anxiety about something and the foolishness that's going on. I was able to pop one, start to mellow out, and as I felt ready, I was able to pop another. That's the point of the micro dosing, right? Mm. You can control how much of it that you actually intake. It's a really great thing for maybe you're not into the actual, you know, weed of it all, you know, but this is, you know, you don't want to puff pass. This is something that will help you mellow out without actually getting high.
This is a unique product and you should check it out. Microdosing is a popular daily practice for people who want to feel better and be healthier. If you're interested in learning more about microdosing THC, just do a quick search online or go to microdosedrops.com/top uses. And if you ever want to experience the benefits of microdosing for yourself, microdosedrops.com delivers to all 50 states. Yes, all 50 states, because I know you were asking. To get free shipping and 30% off your first order, use code FANTI. Links can be found in the show description. But again, that's microdosedrops.com/top uses and code FANTI.
This week's episode is also brought to you by, you know what's coming, Babbel, okay? For most of us, second language in high school, I'm not going to do no foolishness this time.
Okay.
But learning a second language in high school or college wasn't exactly a high point in our academic careers. I do, however, want to shout out Sissy Heidel, who was my Spanish teacher when I was at Morehouse. Shout out to you. She tried her darndest. She really did. She did everything that was necessary.
My Spanish teacher, my senior year was one of the worst teachers I've ever met in my life. I won't say his name because I probably blocked it out, but he was trash. Now, thanks to Babbel, the number one selling language learning app, there's a fun and easy way to learn a new language as opposed to sitting in his trash class. I'm sorry, I'm okay. Babbel teaches bite-sized language lessons that you'll actually use in the real world. Babbel designs their courses with practical real-world conversations in mind, things you'll get to use in everyday life. Other language learning apps use AI for their lesson plans, but Babbel lessons are created with over 100 language experts. Plus, Babbel speech recognition technology helps you to improve your pronunciation and accent. Thanks a lot, Babbel. Right now, when you purchase 3 months worth of Babbel subscription, you'll get an additional 3 months for free. That's 6 months for the price of three. Just go to Babbel.com and use promo code FANTI. That's Babbel.com. Code FANTI for an extra 3 months. That's Babbel, language for life. Welcome back to FANTI. This week, we're talking about service to the community through advocacy and the various different ways that presents itself. And even with a bit of disagreement between the two of us about what that entails, Travelle and I serve in various roles within the National Association of Black Journalists on the national and local levels, while community service is usually a passion and a mission for folks driven with the intention of making things better for our communities. It can also be fucking exhausting. And so we wanted to have a conversation about advocacy work when it comes to our professional lives and how it impacts our personal lives. And I guess first things first, Travelle, what has been your background or experience of serving in advocacy roles?
So I want to make I want to start off by making a distinction between like community service and advocacy, because I see them as different things, right? For me, community service is like Habitat for Humanity. Like, you gonna build somebody a fucking house, you gonna, you know, feed the hungry, you gonna, you know, that type of thing. And then for me, advocacy, I feel like, is, at least in the context of my life, it's a little bit more institutional. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit more about, you know, trying to take a space and make it more inclusive for myself and other people. And I think my kind of introduction, if you will, or my background as it relates to both, I'm going to give my mother credit for this because she was, you know, in the military for 23 years, which is most of my life. And that is a very... at least it's dubbed, I guess, as like serving your country and like giving of potentially your life, you know, to serve and protect the freedoms, you know, that we all say we love. But then again, the military was an option. It was a way out for my mama. Yeah. Like, she enlisted in the military so that she could get us up out of the hood, she says. And that was the literal only reason. Mm-hmm. And she stuck with it for 23 years because, you know, it was paying the bills and it was giving her the chance to travel and it afforded her kids a variety of opportunities. But I think that that's the only thing I can think of in my head as to why I, you know, serve the people as much and in the ways that I serve. What about you?
See, I view it a little bit differently when it comes to the community service piece. I think of my career as having three different lanes of focus: one as a journalist, one as a writer and doing development, and then the third as service. And so I think of the advocacy work that I do within ABJLA and partnering with other groups, specifically around journalism and other things, I think of all of those things as service. One, because we do them for free, goddamn it. But two, like, the intention is the same, to help other people through service in the ways that, you know, that the different ways that shows up. So yes, like going and volunteering at a food bank, or, you know, cleaning up litter, or, you know, doing all of these different things are community service. But I definitely think of advocacy as community service because it is to help, right? To be of aid to the community, or to be of service to the community, if you will. So that's how I see it. I understand how you see it as well. So, but I know that for myself, I've worked in different kinds of advocacy roles. I didn't even realize this until we were talking about it. Really, since high school, I've been a part of this club or organization. You know, I've been on student government in college. I've been, you know, a part of all kinds of different things throughout the years, serving on like state and regional leadership for college and all of these different things. And then as an adult, you know, I'm on the committee for this and the group for that and all of those different things. And I always find the value of those things being you know, really tangible in the ways that we can help within ABJ specifically, the ways that we can help journalists and you know, the media landscape in shaping the narratives for Black and brown people. So that is kind of like my background, like I said, going all the way back to high school, essentially. I want to get into, like, what do you love about advocacy as opposed to the many things that can be frustrating about her?
You know, I feel like the last few episodes we've done, when we've gotten to the fan section,
your list has been short.
My list has been very short. But I think for me, the only thing I can think of is like specific instances of, like, you know, doing work for other people. And so, like, I have to shout out the Bonner Scholars Program at Morehouse College, which is like this community service scholarship program. And it basically requires all the folks who are Bonner Scholars to do, I think it's 280 hours of community service during the academic year, and then another 280 for 2 out of the 3 summers that you have as a student. And so I was working my tail off, honey. Okay, serving the homeless, you know, picking up the trash, building the Habitat for Humanity houses, and all of that while I was at Morehouse. And it was great experience just to be in the community, and things like that. I also think about being a resident advisor. I became a resident advisor because I felt like, you know, to be quite frank, the baby gays needed somebody who was in housing that, like, they could talk to, somebody that they could, like, look up to. I wanted to do programming around LGBTQ identity and stuff like that. And then also at Morehouse, there was a program that we had in the sociology department, like a grant-funded program called Faces of Manhood, in which we as the folks who were chosen for the program, we're supposed to, like, put on events around masculinities and identities, you know, to kind of educate the community. And, like, those are the things that come to mind, those experiences serving. Oh, also, oh my God. So when I was a Bonner Scholar freshman year.
You got really excited just now, and that always makes me anxious.
Freshman year, Bonner Scholar at Morehouse. This was the year before us. The freshman at the time apparently got in a fight when they were, like, at a step show or something like that. I can't remember the exact story. And so the school banned stepping for freshmen, stepping and strolling freshmen. But the group of freshmen who were Bonner Scholars, our, like, student advisor, his name is Chaz Gibson. He basically got a group of us from that group, and we had our own step team, and the school allowed us to step, and we opened for the big step show for homecoming and stuff like that. We were called Servants of Service, SOS for short.
Oh Lord.
But when you were talking, I just remembered how we had these songs and these chants and stuff. And when we would go out in the community and do different service, like if we went to, you know, an old folks home and did work at the old folks home, or we went to the food service centers and stuff like that, we would sing and we would perform for the folks, and they ate it up, honey. I just wanted to share that. If anybody out there, you know, is from my Morehouse days, do not go looking for the video.
Oh,
thank you.
That's the only thing I want to see. If you have the videos, please send them to fanti@maximumfun.org.
They don't have them. You want to know why? Because I got them, okay?
Somebody has it. I will say the fan piece for me about service and advocacy, number one, it's always rewarding. Like, there's always, like, some kind of feedback that you will get from someone.
Oh, yeah, that too. I didn't say rewarding, but that too.
No, you don't get to say shit else, because you hate advocacy, remember? It's all anti for you, except Bonner Scholars. I do love the rewarding nature of, like, being able to serve people. And I will say, as president now of NABJLA, I feel like you and I have, like, very different styles about things. That's probably why this show works. But, like, I thought that the serving piece of being president and having to be so responsive to people and things like that would be really fucking exhausting. And don't get me wrong, It can be. But like, I've enjoyed it more than I expected I would. And that's been a bit of a surprise for me. But also, I enjoy working with like-minded people on a common goal, right? Like, we have a mission that we're out to accomplish, whether it's programming, whether it's advocacy, whether it's, you know, helping students or what have you, or putting on an event. I always enjoy that. And I don't think there's anything that's more rewarding than like having an idea and seeing it come to fruition. I think the biggest thing that we've done so far, you and I together, was the media summit that we put on for our students and professional members here in LA. And like, there was something very rewarding about seeing hundreds of people show up for an event, get, you know, the enrichment and the workshops and the connections and networking and all that kind of stuff. That was really, really great to be able to see the results of that work. And so, like, I enjoy all of those elements of advocacy and service and all of that. Now, on the flip side.
Come on, flip side.
Now, I know you, I'm realizing my list of antis is a little bit longer than yours, but I'm gonna let you start. I mean, I'll first say though, I think the piece of advocacy that gets on my nerves as someone who leads a volunteer organization is not getting paid, because the hours are countless and the money is none.
Yeah.
So.
Well, so that was gonna be my first thing that I was gonna say. I think, you know, and. Listen, all of y'all who's got your critiques of capitalism and all of that, you know, you sit down, okay? We'll come to you later, okay? We got a whole episode for
We're
you.
We're actually so not down. Coming to you, so. I mean, to be clear, you know.
But I do think that for me, when it comes to the payment part, it's that there are people being paid for this work, particularly when we're talking about advocacy in journalistic spaces, when we're talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion work. There are people getting paid, and getting paid very well for that. And then we over here sitting like chopped liver, you know, trying to do the good for the community, you know. Meanwhile, my bills ain't paid, okay? To be clear, my bills
are
paid. I was
going to say, I think in the past episode, you told us that your bills are well paid.
Well, yes. But my point is that for as much work, as much that we put into this type of stuff, to not get paid, I think just is a very real, it's just a very real consideration. And don't get me wrong, I guess we could always transition into doing this work, you know, full time or professionally. And like, maybe we will coming down the line. But it's always interesting to me the ways in which folks expect those of us who are doing this advocacy work to kind of like, you know, make a vow of poverty, to not, you know, get paid for our efforts, or if we're going to get paid for our efforts, to not, that there's a limit to what getting paid for your efforts look like. And that's something that, I don't know if I could say it troubles me, but it's definitely something that I think about. Yeah.
One of the things that's frustrating to me is that when you start doing advocacy work, you start to get pigeonholed into people believing like that's the only thing that you think of or have opinions about or, you know, give a fuck about. And I feel like I've always had to kind of work overtime to be able to do other things outside of talking about Black shit. And I've I've talked to so many, one of my friends who was on the show before, I was telling him about something I was developing, and he was like, also, like, I enjoy talking about stupid shit too. And it reminded me, he was like, you know, I love pop culture just like everybody else does. And I, you know, I have an appreciation for the Real Housewives like everybody else does. And like, but people only want to come talk to me about pain or about Blackness or about racism. And like, I want to talk about Married to Medicine. You know what I mean? Like, I think that people get this idea that the only thing that you bring to the table is your Blackness or your advocacy or your queerness or whatever it is. And I think that sometimes advocate work, it gives people this image that is your whole world. And like, I'm really excited about food and cooking. I'm dining and travel and all of those other things. But like, that is what people tend to see.
And on top of that, if your actual job also mirrors the advocacy work that you do, that further, I think, right, basically pigeonholes you or pushes you into a corner. I tell people all the time, like, listen, I do the black shit. I do the faggot shit. I cool. Got it. I can do that in my sleep. But like, bring me on. That's one of the reasons I loved being on Pop Culture Happy Hour to talk about the Great Pottery Throwdown last week. Like, that is my, that the people don't know, I used to be very into, you know, while you were out trading spaces, yes. Extreme Home Makeover.
Oh my God, like, can we do a show about that? Girl.
Sure, I don't know what the fan and the anti is of it all, but yeah, sure. You want to do a spinoff?
I used to love doing watching Trading Spaces. Remember when the black woman was like, I hate brown. I told her I hate brown. Like, love that bullshit. Like, while you were out, surprised by design, all that kind of bullshit. Anyway, yes. Sorry, we're off topic.
Anyway, yeah, but you know, I think you're so right that, like, it just, it can be kind of debilitating. Mm-hmm. That's what I'll say for me to do the advocacy work, have it match up so closely with my actual, at least the core of my actual reporting. Because then, you know, the girls don't call me to interview Angelina Jolie or Meryl Streep, right? They call me to interview the Blaggetts, okay? And don't get me wrong, I will take that check too, but I can and have interviewed folks who don't come from my lived experience. And that is definitely frustrating about doing the work, for sure.
And, like, I think that, for instance, when I was writing at, like, The Hollywood Reporter, for instance, no shade to them, but, like, I felt like so often the pitches that would get yes had to do with, like, Black Entertainment Awards or the Black show that's coming out or the Black film that's coming out. And it's like, I mean, I want to see the animated movie that's coming out too. Or I want to see this dumbass dog movie that I don't really believe in. No, I don't. I actually don't want to cover that. But like all of these different things that are happening, like the only thing that happens. And I think we actually see this happen in the workplace for a lot of people, right? Like my dad, for instance, he has been pulled into like the diversity and inclusion committee at his job because he's a black manager. And it's like, he doesn't have background in that. But like, he's worked at this company for a number of years and like now he's the black guy to go to and like he's enjoying that. But I also know that there are a lot of people who get pulled into that work that are like, listen, I'm not a DEI expert. I'm just black or I'm just queer or whatever it is. And we've had that conversation back when we had Sharon Smith at Consagna on the show as well.
Can we also talk about, and I know this might be blasphemous because we're talking about advocacy and being selfless and all of that, but like, this is some thankless work.
Oh my God.
Like, you know, and I'm not saying we do it for the thanks and we do it for the recognition, but goddamn, can somebody say thank you? Well, like, to be quite, I think often about, you know, in our script I wrote in NABJLA, when I was president of NABJLA, I gave that organization my blood, my sweat, and my motherfucking tears. Yeah. And while yes, there are, you know, folks that you know, say thank you or applaud you for the work, there's always some motherfucker in the corner who wanna be whispering about what I'm not doing good at, right? They want to ignore the good and hyper-focus on what's not being served. Because when they were leadership, when they were president and VP or whatever the case may be, their focus was somewhere else or they would have done it different. Well, bitch, come on and do it, sis.
I will say that from the thankless piece of it, it's like, I think when you're an advocate, whether it's in the way that we are with NABJLA or NABJ nationally or other organizations or what have you, no matter where you're an advocate, I feel like there's never an appreciation for all of the conversations that no one will ever know that you had. All the meetings that you had to sit in that no one ever knew existed, all of the emails that you had to respond to that were completely out of line. Yes, I'm talking to you.
Ooh. Uh-oh. Okay.
I think to your point, though, like the thanklessness of it is really, really frustrating. And if you were getting into it for like the attention and the applause, like you're in the wrong business, right? Like you're in the wrong field.
Yes. Because and yet still. And yet still. Right.
Well, and I,
dot, dot,
right.
Dot.
And one of my things was saying, like, one of my antis was, if you don't believe in what you're doing, it's really hard to give a fuck. And like, sometimes you have to be a part of things that you don't really care about. It's an event, or it's a panel, or it's a meeting, or a discussion, or being on a board, or whatever it is that you kind of get swept into. But it's like, if you don't really care about it, it's like, why am I allocating X amount of time for this to be on my calendar? Why do I have to give my time to this or my money? Right? Like, I think that's the other piece that people don't think about, is like, being in a volunteer position as an advocate ends up costing you money, right? It doesn't just take your time.
Don't tell me, don't get me started about when I joined the National NABJ board, you know, and maybe I should have known this going into it, but there is a requirement that all of the board members give something, you know, financially to the organization. It also is an expectation that board members will bring money into the organization. And because so much of the work, for me at least, can feel like moving mountains, right? I'm not talking about bringing money in and raising the profile of an organization. I'm talking about shifting people's minds, shifting processes, establishing and instituting, you know, processes that make a space more inclusive for folks who deserve and should be welcome in those particular spaces. It feels like moving mountains. No, Ursha, if you out there and you know the reference and you know the song I'm talking about, shout out to you. If you don't, that's okay too. But it can really feel like moving mountains in doing this work, and then to have all of this resistance to your efforts, and then also not get paid, and then also not get a thank you. Oh, you motherfuckers playing with me in my face.
You know what? Okay. You know what? I can feel that you're getting really hot here. So I'm going to just say, like, I hope y'all haven't minded us airing our grievances in this moment.
They'll be all right.
That's what, that's what I feel like it's turning into gradually. But I do think that as we look at, like, at people who do advocacy work, I do think that more people need to have an appreciation for, one, how much work goes into that, and two, like, the work of advocacy is to change hearts, right? I'm so involved in, like, political conversation about this, that, and the other. And like, one of the frustrating things in politics is that you can't legislate the changing of people's hearts, right? You can only legislate trying to make things more equal. You can legislate trying to make things more fair or whatever. And you can use the penal system to punish people when they don't do this or that. But like, you can't legally change people's hearts. And we've seen that through the Trump era. Like, we haven't seen it in a long time. But I think that the work of advocacy is to try and change people's hearts, to try to make them see things a little bit differently, and to make things better for the people you're advocating for. And so that is really what ends up bringing me back all the time, because I feel like it's important work, even if it's frustrating and angering sometimes. So that's that.
I will say this. I ask myself every day. Every day I wake up and I have to do something for NABJLA or NABJ or one of the other handful of organizations that I'm part of. I'm not going to lie to you. I ask myself, why the fuck am I doing this? And yet, guess what? I still do it, like Boo Boo the Fool, you know, painting my face with the clown makeup, honey, and still show up with a smile on, okay? And so I think that that shows, at least for me, the fact that I'm still doing it, I think there is something that tethers me to the work. It tethers me to the idea of, you know, wanting to transform a space, wanting to make more space for folks who look like me in the various rooms that I show up in. But, you know, I'm still going to complain. So y'all gonna deal with it.
Well,
love you much.
Coming up, we're gonna talk about why y'all hate us so much and listener feedback and our dishonorable mentions as we go to break. We want to know, what kind of advocacy work are you familiar with, and what is your perspective on advocacy if you're participating in it, or, you know, just one of the people who's complaining in my DMs. Tweet or post using hashtag FantiFam. We'll be jumping in and responding to your posts on Twitter and Instagram from at FantiPodcast. Want to know what we missed you have to say. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Are you riddled with guilt over your TBR pile?
Are you filled with shame about a book that you just can't seem to finish?
Are you having regrets because grad school killed your love of reading?
We're Reading Glasses, and we're here to help.
I'm Mallory.
And I'm Bria.
Let us absolve you of all your reading guilt.
Stuck on a book you don't like?
We'll help you dump it.
Can't figure out what to read next?
We'll recommend something in your wheelhouse.
Can't decide where to buy your books from?
We'll point you in the right direction.
No matter what you read or how you read it,
we'll help you do it better.
Reading Glasses, every Thursday on Maximum Fun.
Macho Man to the top rope. The flying elbow. The cover. We've got a new champion.
We're here with Macho Man Randy Savage after his big win to become the new world champion. What are you going to do now, Match?
I'm going to go listen to the newest episode of the Tights and Fights podcast. Oh, yeah.
Tell us more about this podcast.
It's the podcast of power, too sweet to be sour, funky like a monkey, woke discussions, man, and jokes about wrestlers' fashion choices, myself excluded, yeah.
I can't wait to listen.
Neither can I. You can find it Saturdays on Maximum Fun. Oh, yeah, dig it.
Welcome back, beautiful people. We are going to get into our listener feedback segment, which we read out your emails. So we've got a couple notes here. I'm going to start first with an email from Nina. This is in response to our nigga episode. And they start out by saying, I really appreciated today's episode. Your honesty, you're fabulous, you're great, amazing, all of that. I am South Asian, and when I came to the U.S. as a child, we lived in Brooklyn. The first non-Indians I became friends in school with were Jamaican and Korean immigrants. I still remember the eagerness with which we shared our lunches and our cultures. It was with this sense of excitement that I greeted our move to LI, which I'm going to assume is Long Island, and my new school. There, I was the darkest child in school and called a nigger by many of the white children I met. How do I tell my story and convey the hurt, pain, and isolation by sterilizing these memories and saying that I was called, quote, the N-word? How does my brother, who presents as Arab, tell his story of being threatened in a parking lot by a drunk white man screaming that he was a, quote, dirty sand nigger by sanitizing the frightening language being hurled at him? This is hard for me to process. This word contains a host of pain that hasn't been directed towards me or people like me, and I acknowledge this, but by neutering the language we use to tell our stories, I feel like the ones who benefit are white people who least deserve it.
This is a good one. First of all,
sis, this might have been a tough question.
Listen, okay, Nina, wow. I would say that if you are recounting your experience of being called a nigger or a dirty sand nigger, like all of these really, really awful things, I think you can say it. I mean, you present as, you, Travelle, you disagree? You guys can't see Travelle's face, but I mean, I think if you've had the experience of being called a nigger, especially like, I mean, I don't know how often non-black people get called nigger in ways that are not derogatory by white people. But like, I don't even know if that question, the way I frame that makes sense, but y'all know my heart, or you don't. I feel like you should be able to say like, no, I was called a dirty sand nigger, or I was called a nigger by white people. And like, who's gonna argue with you about that, that you shouldn't have said it?
I think a number of people would argue about it. I think there's a need to be intentional about the telling of their stories, because right, I think if someone's using the word, using nigger to detail the ways in which the word has been used against them and towards them, there still is an element of anti-blackness in the core of the usage of the word. And I think that there needs to be some sort of recognition done verbally that recognizes that recognizes the ways in which the word was not only directed at the individual who is not black, but what the person was actually saying, or also saying and using nigger in the first place in terms of its, you know, role as it relates to black people. I don't know how that's done. I might take a couple extra sentences, but if you're telling me, you can do whatever you want, to be clear, Nina, it's your life. However, if you were recounting this story to me, I feel like I would want you to preface the telling of your story by saying, I'm going to use some language that I understand, you know, has a number of connotations, but I'm using it for a purpose, right? And then detailing your story, I think what that does for me is that there's no need for me to then be on alert. But if you're telling your story and you say sand nigga, and then you continue telling your story, and even if you do the disclaimer or whatever on the back end, I don't know, that feels a little too late for me. But I also don't know, because I do think this is super complicated. And I don't want you to feel like, you or your brother to feel like y'all have to sanitize the language to talk about the vitriol that has been directed at y'all. But I also am wondering about the Black folks that are around that may feel a way. I don't know. Y'all, I'm going to have to think on this. Y'all got to give me time to think on this.
I think the trigger warning request is a fair one, that you're making here. But I think, you know, I stand by what I said. I think if this happened to you and, you know, you are a woman of color, person of color, people of color, I think you can say what happened. Yeah. Good letter, Nina.
Yeah, thank you so that much for that. I wanted to do a quick passing mention. We got an email from Vanessa in response to the segment that we had talking about Lil Nas X's video Montero, aka Call Me By Your Name. And Vanessa basically details some, you know, complex and complicado feelings that they were having around the video, because there were reports that ended up coming out that that the video was plagiarizing or too closely inspired by or whatever FKA Twigs's video for her video Cellophane. And I mean, I just wanted to note that, like, that's all been cleared up, and like, they both have talked and posted about it. And so I just wanted to note that for the folks who might have felt similarly to Vanessa. So look at their social media pages to figure out, you know, to see how they both addressed those issues, if you will.
I feel like I'm supposed to have something witty to say about plagiarism here. Something. Moving on.
You're not. I wasn't even thinking about that.
I wasn't saying you were. I feel like people, whenever the word plagiarism comes up, people look at me and I'm like, hey, girl, carry on.
Okay. Well, second email that I want to kind of go a little deep in. This is an email from Antonio regarding our This Is My Sorry For 2004.
No, thank you.
And I ain't gonna mess up no more.
No, thank you. I didn't like it when Ruben did
this
it.
This year.
Wow.
I mean, it was definitely better when Ruben did it. Okay, so this is an email from Antonio, like I said, regarding our apologies episode. Okay. And they said, part of growth is having compassion and being able to talk about / confront your mistakes with whoever it may have negatively affected. The shame that you may have originally felt when you realized you committed the wrong should disappear if you've truly grown past it. In a one-to-one relationship with a partner, for example, if I fuck up, talk it out with my partner, and we find a solution together, there should be mutually agreed upon redemption there if I'm not repeating those mistakes. If my partner continues to bring up the issue, even though we've solved it and I haven't made the same mistakes, that's unfair for sure, but this isn't the scenario of public figures, and I think they need to realize that. Travell was right, not in a Travell greater than Jared way, because both of you are fucking amazing.
Let's be clear. I'm clear on why you chose this letter now, but carry on.
True T, I didn't even read this far. Not even gonna lie to you. You always have to be okay to address it if people bring it up, because as a public figure, unfortunately or fortunately, you don't have one-to-one relationships anymore. You have one to hundreds, maybe thousands of relationships. And that doesn't mean your apology or solution may work for everyone in those relationships. You have to be able to talk about it whenever someone brings it up, if you truly have grown from it, not just for yourself, but so you can be an example of how growth works. Jared, to your point about case by case, I still feel like if someone has truly grown, they will always be able to talk about it if they have truly grown from it. If they shut down the conversation, it shows they haven't grown or have a lack of compassion, at least. Jared, you also mentioned the conversation with that person from a few years ago where they were like, that was a long time ago. If they started that conversation with, hey, I'm sorry what I did affected you like that, I get why you feel that way, but I'm not that person anymore, it was a long time ago, but I've learned X, Y, and Z, and I would never do that again. Is there any way that I can, this is a whole quote, by the way, y'all. Is there any way I can make up for what I did, or is there anything I'm missing? Maybe you, Jared, might have been able to get past it with that person, but believe me, I get why you couldn't with a quote, that was a long time ago type of motherfucker. Love your show. They're out in Canada, and they say if we're ever there, to say, to holla. sorry, that was a lot. That was a long email, but I thought it was a good one.
Well, thank you, Antonio, for your letter. I don't have to see this the same way. I get the reference that you make at the end about the that was a long time ago conversation that I had with the person. I think that if in the conversation that I had with that person, they acknowledged it and said, like, this is what I did and, you know, the choices that I were making, blah, 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 and, like, apologized for it in that moment, I don't really feel like I have a whole bunch of points to be able to keep bringing it up time and time again later. Like, sure, there might be, you know, residual repercussions that, you know, make themselves evident in, you know, the days, weeks, months, years later. And I might want to talk about that or whatever, but like expecting them to continually apologize to me for it feels like more than I think is necessary, but I get the perspective.
Well, that's not what Antonio said, to be clear. Antonio said for public figures and celebrities, it's different versus that one-to-one that you had with a specific person.
But I feel the same way about it for both, right? I don't know that the person
needs... Right, I just wanted to clarify that's not what he said. He's saying they're two separate situations. You're saying that you feel the same about both.
Yeah, I think that if Kevin Hart had like given like a solid apology to the LGBTQ community and had, you know, really done some work around it, I don't think 5-10 years later someone's going to be like, remember how 15 years ago you said X thing? You need to apologize to me about that because it offended me. I don't know that that's necessary. I just don't.
Well, you just went real extra with that. And I in the way you framed it, I think I agree with you. But I say what I said. And whatever the hell I said, I guess that's what I believed last week or week before last. I might feel different if I listen back to it, but I'm not going to. All right, we're going to get into our honorable and dishonorable mentions, our opportunity to highlight or call out some of the foolishness you faves or lack of faves are doing out there. Jared, do you want to get us started?
Sure. I want to give a dishonorable mention to the Apple Watch. I find it to be more annoying than it is convenient. I say that with mine sitting here.
Ain't nobody tell you to spend your money on it no way.
They did not. And I I think if we were not in quarantine and working from home in the ways that we have been over the last year, maybe I would enjoy it more. But I know that in times when I'm trying to like unwind or disconnect, I will just take the shit off. Because even being on Do Not Disturb, it wants to remind me that I need to fucking breathe, that it wants me to stand up in this hour, that I didn't take enough steps today, that I need to, you know, drink water or go advocate for somebody else. And I'm sick of the shit. Mind you, I still wear it every day. Most days, I would probably say 5 or 6 days a week. But like, I'm tired of the Apple Watch and I wish that I could get my money back. But I also kind of love it. So
you can give it to me if you don't want it.
Let's not get crazy. The other people I want to give a dishonorable mention to, an honorable mention to, are the folks from an organization called Walk Good LA. I went and did this past Sunday. I went and did Black Yoga in the Park. Well, I'm calling it Black Yoga in the Park. That's not what they're calling it. But if you're here in Los Angeles, Walk Good LA is their Instagram and they do this black yoga event every Sunday at 10 o'clock in the morning. And it is like hip hop music and R&B and just a ton of black folks and some non-black folks, but it's, you know, it's primarily black. And like, it's just really, really dope. And I think it's a really cool way that the folks over at Walk Good LA have, you know, created a new space for black folks, but they also do running and hiking and all kinds of other things. And I really, really enjoyed it. So.
Shout out to Etienne, who is the person over Walk Good LA, the person who kind of created and came up with that. Etienne also happens to be the son of the legendary Cheryl Lee Ralph, who we were talking about earlier. That might have been off mic, but yeah. Shout out to you, Etienne. We see you. Hey.
And I think someone named Marley also runs it. I don't know her personally, but I know I've heard her name multiple times as well. So, and those are my mentions.
Perfect. All right. So I just have two quick honorable mentions. I first and foremost want to give a shout out to the one and only Danielle Brooks, who starred as the legendary Mahalia Jackson in a Lifetime movie that I think premiered a couple of weeks ago at this point. I just had a chance to see it. I saw it last week, but we were on little vacation. She just put her foot in that fucking role in the name of Jesus, and you all should check it out if you have not seen it yet. Danielle Brooks of Orange is the New Black fame. She played Tasty on that show, and so she just did an amazing job, as well as everybody else in the film. But it's her starring role, and she deserves. And then I also want to give an honorable mention to Ye Jung Yoon. I believe is how you say her name. She is, if you've seen Minari, the film Minari, one, if you haven't seen it, do yourself a favor and just delve into that excellence. But if you have seen it, she plays the grandmother. She was nominated and won a BAFTA award earlier this week. And her acceptance speech is just hilarious to me. And so I just wanted to like lift that up.
What is Minari about?
Minari is an American story about a Korean American family. They move to a farm in Arkansas in search of its own American dream. Amidst the challenges of this new life in the strange and rugged Ozarks, they discover the undeniable resilience of family and what really makes a home.
Oh, now as a person who watches Ozark on Netflix, I'm just excited to see some people that ain't white in Ozark, so I might go watch that. 'Cause baby,
it's directed by Lee Isaac Chung, and it's the main star. It really is a vehicle for the talent that is Steven Yeun. And so definitely check it out. Like, every actor in that film is firing on all cylinders, and it is beautiful. It's nominated for some Oscars and all these other awards and stuff like that too. But it's great. Check it out, and shout out to Ye Jung Yoon. Okay, now we're going to do our Black History is Happening Every Day. Cue music. Black History is Happening Every Day. And, you know, Jared, FYI, I am going off script for our Black History Month moment. And I have prepared a selection again. And it goes a little like this. Happy birthday to you. Oh, happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday, dear Jared.
Happy birthday to you. All I want for my birthday is a big booty. All I want for my birthday is a big booty. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
Can I stop you? Please. Please stop. Because when
are you starting to sweat of the attention?
Well, so the thing about the Stevie Wonder version is, there's no good place for it to end when people start singing it, because after you get through the happy birthday to you, then you get to the happy birthday. It's like, stop, please, abort mission. There's no good place to fade it out, but thank you.
I just wanted to take an opportunity. When you all hear this episode, Jared's birthday is this coming weekend, and I just wanted to, you know, you are your own Black History moment. Oh. We are grateful that you were born and that you have gone on to provide us so much Black and queer excellence. It is great to see you looking so young and sprightly at 50 years old.
I was going
to
say, fuck Jordan in the comments for saying the big 5-0. I see you, Jordan.
I legitimately just wanted to give you some flowers on this podcast. I know people think I hate you and all of that, but I really do love you and appreciate your friendship and your co-hostership. Is that a word? It's not a word.
No.
But all of that. And so you deserve, I'm sending you some things, you know, on, you know, the actual day and stuff. So stay tuned.
Well, thank you. I wasn't prepared for you to be singing again. Thank you so much. Thank you. I appreciate that. I turn 36 this coming Sunday, April 18th, and I am looking forward to it. I'm really excited about my birthday this year. My best friend, Michael, just called me, and I'm sure he's calling to say happy birthday while I'm on Fanti right now.
Hi, Michael.
And I'll have to call
Michael
you back.
Michael was in one of our early episodes.
but I, Michael listens to the show, so he'll appreciate that. I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. All right, we're going to get the heck up on out of here. But before we do that, I do want to give a quick plug. I am back on Pop Culture Happy Hour talking about the excellence that is Queen Sugar with Aisha Harris. Be sure to check that out if you're interested, for sure.
That's right. And also, if this conversation, you know, spoke to you and you want to get some more of this.
Goo goo.
Ooh, take your time. Episode 52, HBCUs Are a Different World, featuring Panama Jackson from Very Smart Brothers, is another conversation that, you know, kind of has some of the similar themes of what we spoke about here. We thank you so much for listening. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, we ask that you give us a 5-star rating and a review. Let us know what you think about the show, because it helps people to find the show, learn more about what we're talking about, and then hopefully listen to it. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's episode, you can tweet at us at Fanti Podcast, or follow us on Twitter or Instagram at Fanti Podcast, and use the hashtag FantiFam to jump into the conversation about what we're doing and how you can be a part of it.
Yes, and as always, you can also email us many, many of your thoughts at fanti@maximumfun.org. Our music is provided by the one and only Corece. That's Core.ece. You can grab that wherever you get Slayworthy audio. And our graphics are done by the one and only Ashley Wen and Moonhouse Creative.
That's right. Our producers are Laura Swisher and Jordan Cowley. This is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.
Yeah.